Chuck Show Show. Welcome. I'm music writer, author, and total pop nutcase, Pete Pavides.
Hello, I'm music writer, author, and obsessive cultural weirdo, Sian Pattenden, and this is the next instalment of the Heritage Chart Show show. If you heard the first two, you might be even less clear about what the Heritage Chart Show is than ever before. Nonetheless, we will try and explain.
The Heritage Chart Show is invented by legendary broadcaster Mike Reed for pop fans over the age of 35, apparently. And the Heritage Chart Show show is...
an outlet for our mental obsession with chart rundowns and our unerring belief that we live in a world where they are still relevant. Plus, it is an outlet for our never-ending fascination with Mike Reed's Heritage Chart. As heritage-adjacent Johnny Nash so prophetically put it, there are more questions than answers, and the more I find out, the less I know. And I say prophetically because he could have been describing the experience of watching Mike Reed's Heritage Chart show.
He certainly could. Anyway, thank you for your wonderful responses to our first two efforts. Scottish listener Basil Pieroni says, I've enjoyed the shows so far. It's a bizarre concept, both the original show and doing a podcast about it. But you're hitting more gold than the top 10. Lawrence and Sean, both excellent guests with some great anecdotes. Looking forward to hearing the next one. The great Jeff Lloyd of Absolute Radio and host of the wonderful Reasons to Be Cheerful podcast with Ed Miliband wrote in to say, this podcast is great and I haven't even seen the Heritage Chart Show yet. It's funny, it correctly treats pop music as both the most important and least important thing in the world, and there's nothing snide about it.
That's amazing, isn't it? You can go to www.heritagechart.co.uk to find out more. That is Mike Reed's own website. I say you might find out more, but you actually just might be completely more confused. Leaving you less bemused is the fact you can buy us a virtual coffee at www.buymeacoffee.com/Pete and Sian, all one word. It helps pay for studio costs and for some of our running jokes. But let's stop mithering, let's pick an episode and meet our special guest.
She's a sweet soul sister, and there ain't no mister that'll ever get the better of Sally. So treat your feet to the beat that's neat with your favourite girl MC. She's the queen, she's the queen, she's the queen of the rapping scene, especially when she's wrapping presents for the Christmas packages sent out by Beauty Banks, the charity she co-founded, which sources and distributes hygiene products like soap, toothpaste, sanitary products and shampoo for people who can't afford them. It's cosmetics guru, activist, author and all-round excellent human, Sally Hughes.
Thank you very much. That's much nicer than drunk men coming up to me and singing Don't Look Back in Anger at me in pubs, because that's happened to me many times.
Has it really?
Yes, as though it's the first time it's happened to me.
Have I missed something? Is there something intrinsic to
Well,
you?
My name is in the chorus.
Oh, yes.
The anglicised version of my name is in the chorus. That's normally what happens.
Oh, man.
I know.
Commiserations.
Yeah. Drunk men stop doing it.
Yeah.
Can you
you're
stop?
Definitely
can
not
you
the
stop
first.
Now?
Definitely not the first.
Well, so yes, that was an interpolation of Queen of the Rapping. Do you remember Queen of the Rapping scene by
yes.
Modern Romance?
Yes.
It suddenly came to mind this morning, didn't it? It was just like, yeah, that's a good way to describe a human, isn't it?
Indeed. Yeah. And Jeff Dean of Modern Romance. I bet you both know him, don't you?
Well, only on the internet.
Yeah.
Only sort of bits on the internet.
I don't, but he's written a very good book.
Yeah,
and yeah, mohair suits to kinky boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a bit of a fella, isn't he? We should
he
get him on at
I'd
some
like
point.
To meet him.
Yeah, yeah, he's a bit of a good one.
So the Heritage Chart Show, Sally, you're a big fan.
I love it so much. I love it so much, and I have you to thank for that. So your wife is my closest friend, and she texted me one morning and said, I have discovered your favourite programme, your new favourite programme. And she said that Pete had been keeping her up at night watching this programme and I had to see it at my earliest convenience. So I duly came round, when was it? Several months ago now, and watched it. And life has never quite been the same.
No, there's no going back, definitely. How do you feel it sort of sits in the musical stratosphere?
It sits in its own stratosphere, doesn't it? I don't think you can reasonably place it in any other universe. Mm. It exists entirely on its own, and I think Mike's happy with that. I think that's where Mike thinks it should be, deserves to be. I have had a very long-term fascination with Mike Reed that predates this programme by decades. Mm.
Tell us about this, Sally. So, as if we're your therapist. What's going on with you and Mike?
So I genuinely, unironically loved Saturday Superstore. Mm. I really, really, really loved it. Loved Sarah Green, loved Mike Reed, loved all that. Then, of course, there was the highly problematic Bad Fame series on Channel 4 that featured I'm Your Number One Fan with Blue Tulip Rose Reed, Mike Reed's stalker, which, of course, I was obsessed with. I mean, I'm not proud of it now, but I was obsessed with it at the time.
It was
a cultural moment.
Word of mouth things that people used to kind of go to each other's houses and they'd recorded it and they, you know, the Blue Rose Tulip.
It was very much the kind of Chris Needham era. It was the In Bed with Chris Needham era of kind of the beginnings of reality TV and video diaries. And it was one of those kind of things with a cult following. But really, my fascination turned into obsession in 2007. There was a series on Channel 4 called Get Your Act Together with Harvey Goldsmith. So Harvey Goldsmith had 6 months to turn six entertainment businesses acts around simultaneously. He was working on them all simultaneously. And he had to relaunch Samantha Mumba's career. He had to turn around an orchestra of some kind or a brass band or something. And one of his projects was Big L 1395, which was a radio station that kind of featured disenfranchised, discombobulated former Radio 1 and commercial radio DJs, one of whom was Mike Reed, another was Diddy David Hamilton. They had kind of been persuaded to go to this radio station, and the brief was, you can play what you want, which, of course, is like red rag to a bull for Mike Reed. I kid you not, they were broadcasting from above the Woolwich Building Society in Frinton-on-Sea. And that sounds too much, but it's actually true. And they were losing, Harvey was brought in because they were losing £50,000 a month because they had no listeners, the website didn't work, it was just pandemonium. Harvey goes in to sort it out. To say Mike Reed is resistant to this would be an understatement. He's furious. He's absolutely furious. He hates all of Harvey's ideas, all of the kind of suggestions for the business. He's furious. He just simply says, oh, we need more listeners. It's not my fault. We need more listeners. As though this is something that can just be brought in regardless of the content of the channel. Anyway, he says, and I am going somewhere with this because I do think this is the precursor. This is why the Heritage Chart is such a natural progression from this documentary. He says versions of this repeatedly, but at one point Mike says, I'm sadly, for my sins, been cursed with being an ideas man. It's what I do. And he says versions of this throughout the programme, but he says that verbatim. I'm cursed. Yeah, I'm cursed. Well, I'm just an ideas man. This is what I do. He says, I have millions of ideas better than Harvey Goldsmith. Harvey Goldsmith, of course, the founder of XFM, not to mention a promoter for Springsteen, Madonna, Live Aid, you name it. Smash It's Paul Winner's Party. He's got a career behind him. And Mike dismisses him completely. And in the end, Harvey can't take any more and walks off the project, having seen none of his ideas come to fruition or even attempted. And he leaves Mike and Diddy there. Diddy, Mike and the controller of the Big L all live in a detached house in Frinton-on-Sea. So it's like a Father Ted.
Yeah.
It's like a kind of Father Ted situation. Yeah, they all kind of get pissed every night on Blossom Hill, literally on Blossom Hill. And they take it in turns to cook Shepherd's pie. Yeah. And they all sit together and they eat and they moan about the state of music and the state of radio. Mm. And at one point, Mike says that all the successful working DJs on the BBC and on commercial radio that he knows have told him that they're envious of his new job. Mm-hmm. So I mention this because it felt, when I sat down to watch the Heritage Chart with Pete for the first time many months ago, for me it just felt like a very organic
progression. Really,
yes.
You just described the egg from which the Heritage Chart show hatched, essentially.
Yeah. You have been on a journey, Sally.
I've really been on a journey for a very long time, man. It's really come home to roost for me. I feel like it's paid dividends.
How could I have known when I sat you down to watch the first Heritage Chart show that it was to be your destiny? That's amazing.
You can now, you could not for years, but you can now watch the entire episode on YouTube if you look
for
it.
Which I will be doing this.
Get your act together.
I didn't remember watching it at the time, but your recall is just amazing, and I have to go back.
I've watched it many, many times.
I remember Harvey being very angry, mainly.
Furious.
Yeah,
I've not watched this at all. So my night's viewing is now absolutely sorted.
He's absolutely furious throughout. Mike is furious, and so is Harvey. But you can watch the whole 43 minutes or whatever it is on YouTube.
Fantastic.
Wow. Okay.
Listeners, do that too. I was going to ask, is there a heritage sector of the world of cosmetics?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I literally wrote a book on it.
Yes.
This is why.
Yes, tell us about that then. What are the parallels?
So my second book was about iconic beauty products and some of them, so through the ages, products that kind of changed the world or changed the way men and women groom, I suppose. Some of them still exist, some of them are long gone, and some of them are sort of resurrected. I suppose you could say the heritage products are things like 8-Hour Cream by Elizabeth Arden, Palmolive Shaving Cream, Noxzema, that kind of thing. Things that have just kept on trucking and waited for things to come back around to their way of thinking.
It's a brilliant, Pretty Iconic is the book that you wrote, and it's a fantastic book. And it was a book that I just opened, not really knowing just how fascinated I would be by its contents, but it was just such a delightful Proustian rush.
Oh, thank you.
Sections on the body shop. I mean, I used to hang out in the body, because the body shop was so aspirational.
Also, lots of hot girls in the body shop, I would think, as a kid.
You're right, yes. And, you know, like, if I had any spare pennies left after I bought records, I'd buy those little disposable balls of soap. The bath pearls, yes. Thank you very much.
I used to wear that Body Shop vanilla perfume. And as you may remember, after 3 or 4 months, because it was natural in quotes, it smelt of Play-Doh. Uh-huh. So for years, I smelt of Play-Doh, but didn't really know where it was coming from.
That's a great smell.
Do you think? When people go, what is this? Yeah, what is that? And I was unaware.
I love the smell of Play-Doh.
Really? Well, I thought, I might take that up again. I had
thought
that was a negative.
For me, the smell of the Body Shop is white musk, which is the smell of teenage shagging in the 80s, I think.
And an ace reminds me of that. Anyway,
right.
Maybe we should talk about the Heritage Chart Show.
Hey. Yes.
Let us begin then. This week we discuss episode 22, which is Two Little Ducks, isn't it? Swans or something, or sort of badgers, I don't know. If you're tuning in now, listeners, this is from 2022 and includes a chart war between members of Katrina and the Waves, a very controversial inclusion by the Proclaimers, and yet another cameo from Mike Reed in one of the videos, which is now something of a regular occurrence in this show. Hey. It's Mike's rules, of course. Mike's world. We just live in it. Sally, you wanted us to pick something at random, so we chose this. Why did you want random rather than the latest one?
I don't know. I like to be surprised. And actually, we'll get to it, but I found this earlier episode, which I think is in 2022. I feel like it's evolved as a show. I find it slightly different from the more recent shows. So I'm sure we can discuss that along the way.
Yes.
We start with Mike's intro and the fact... For it is a fact, surely, that this time 78 countries voted in the Heritage Chart. I'm now minded of Eurovision, of course. Why had it not occurred to me before? It's moving in on that crew. Post-pop heritage music is basically Finland. Null point. Any takers for that theory?
What, your theory is that he's in competition with Eurovision?
Yeah, suddenly it's the amount of countries that voted.
He's very proud of that figure.
And he's now punctuating everything with so-and-so voted, Miami voted, Hawaii voted, all this sort of thing. Oh, I see. This is the audience that he wants. Eurovision is once a year, but this is every week. This is how you catch those viewers. Some people who are after a bit of history, nostalgia, but camp also.
Yes, he's very proud of that figure, isn't he? And he likes to remind you of it often.
And as we know, it's now 90 countries and over, so he's probably very proud that we've leapt up 22 countries.
Yeah, also. Yeah.
No, that's my maths, 12 countries.
12.
Sorry, everybody. Yeah.
I didn't like to say.
You know, I'm not very good at school stuff.
The first song we go to, number 40, in at 40, we've got UB40 and a new entry with Champion. Sally, what did you make of this?
So this kicks off a theme that continues throughout the entire show over who owns a pop group.
Yes.
And this comes up multiple times during this episode alone. And I think it's very much a kind of rich area
for
the Heritage Chart Show, this idea of, you know, former members of a lineup of different incarnations of a band popping up and sort of being first in there with the name. So with this, we have the hotly contested group name of UB40 because Ali is not in this performance or in this lineup. And what they're doing, just to date this for you, as I say, this is from 2022. So this is the official song of the Commonwealth Games in Brum. And they're going for a bit of a, with the video, they're going for a bit of a Harder Than You Think, Public Enemy, Channel 4 ident, aren't they? So famously, the Paralympics had that amazing, brilliant use of Harder Than You Think with all the Paralympians kind of killing it on the, the basketball court, on the field, on the track. And they've kind of emulated that in this slightly lower budget video.
Although quite high budget compared to some of the others.
Yes, I assume there was some kind of sports council grant involved. So they could do something with it.
And this is their first single with their new lead singer, their third in total now, because he replaces Duncan Campbell, who was the third Campbell brother. Mm. We didn't say so, the Paul Gallagher of...
miss Duncan's reign.
Yeah, well, I can help you with this because I interviewed Ali Campbell a couple of months after he left UB40. And, I mean, the rancour has continued. I thought, well, they'll probably sort of make up at some point, but the rancour has continued throughout. All sorts of claims and counterclaims flying back and forth. The gist of this split, the complaint that the rest of UB40 or factions that the rest of UB40 made about Ali Campbell is he'd sort of become accustomed to a lifestyle he couldn't maintain. At one point, they said that he bought his wife a £2,000 pair of Gucci jeans. As that's a sort of example of the kind of extravagance.
Profligacy.
Yes. That you know, just doesn't work in a band that's got eight members in it.
Yeah, and ironic that they're called UB40, etc., but carry on.
Yes, good point. And so Duncan... So there was who knew there was a third Campbell? Duncan Campbell stepped in and had his moment in the sun. I only found out yesterday, but Duncan Campbell is the only person in British history who has learnt to play the spoons to a professional level.
No level in spoons.
The only person in Britain?
Ever, apparently. professionally. But there's a level that you sort of
B-tech.
Qualify.
Yeah.
What's the where you become a session spooner?
Yeah. Essentially, yeah. There's a preeminent spoon practitioner.
So there's a governing body.
Yeah, but presumably you have to have a mentor and they'd be better at spoons than you.
Right.
Or maybe you just take over or something. What are the practicalities?
So it's being like a bit like a chess grandmaster or something.
So it's like a who created God type thing that you're asking there. Really,
yes, it's a chicken and egg. But this is the big stuff already. Yeah.
So it was my clearly misunderstanding. I thought that the spoons were like a British pub Cockney classic sort of an instrument and you would expect Britain to be the heartland, really, of accomplished spooners.
I think maybe in sections of Scandinavia they might have some popularity as well. And maybe in Germany, in the beer halls of Germany, I imagine spoons might...
An Oktoberfest situation.
Yes. Spoonfest. Yes.
There's a very, very angry statement on the... So there's the UB40 featuring Ali Campbell website.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the UB40 website. So this is and UB40 are very cross that Ali Campbell is calling himself UB40 featuring Ali Campbell. You can really see this in this recent statement. I'll just give you a flavour of it.
Yes, please do.
It has continually come to our attention that Ali's former bandmates and their current management are hell-bent on trying to stop UB40 featuring Ali Campbell from performing shows globally, including Ali's forthcoming show in Uganda. It goes on. For some time now, the promoters of Ali's shows and TV stations have been flooded with calls and emails from the aforementioned that UB40 will not be performing, citing that Ali Campbell has no legal right to use the name and threatening him with legal action. I'll spare you the most of it, but it's... he's very, very angry.
I mean, we'll be revisiting the most explosive example of this theme later on. It does keep popping up in this episode. It certainly does.
But one does think, you know, he could surely change it and keep the brand. I mean, I know there's the sticking your heels in, but UB50, we'd know what that was about. P45, we'd know what was Universal Credit login problems. We'd know that there was a sort of theme going on there. And I'd say just one of them, let it go. Yeah. I mean, as I told Pete earlier, I have read a PDF about Buddhism last week. because life gets stressful. And these are the things I'm thinking. There's an attachment theory there. What I like about this song is it's very, very similar to... We were talking about Liam Gallagher and...
John Squire
last week. And there's a sort of You Go Girl element that I know it's about the Commonwealth Games, but it actually is that keep soldiering on, you're strong, you can do this. And there was something rather lovely. And big props to Daps on the Map, who's the rapper in it, who's just great. And then I got into a wormhole kind of cul-de-sac of just watching him on YouTube. I quite like it. Irony of the song being it's quite relaxed.
Yeah.
And yet it's about sport. So it's a little bit sit on the sofa and have a spliff, mate, but, you know,
yeah,
it's still about being the best you can be if you can be bothered to get off the sofa.
I felt it was a cut above the usual offering. Yeah. Really. I felt it brought the average up a fair bit.
And it brings the average age down as well. At the same time as the Heritage Chart Show.
Yes, I suppose it does. I mean, I feel fondly towards UB40. I can't help it. I do.
Yeah. I their debut album, Signing Off, it's one of my favourite albums of all time. Though generally, you know, very, very sort of heavy reggae album at the time. And I'd say this is a very good song. Often you do get this with bands that suddenly get a new lead singer. They will come back with a very strong effort because having a new singer sort of galvanized. So like when the Kaiser Chiefs came back, their first single. Well, it wasn't a new lead singer, but they got a drummer to replace the guy who wrote all the songs. So when you got a point to prove, often.
I noticed they're now in a TV commercial I saw a couple of days ago for something I've forgotten about. They're in...
Isn't it the tea? What is it?
Is it tea?
Yorkshire tea, yeah.
Well, that would make sense because of Leeds, I suppose.
Right.
But, they're in a sort of groceries commercial as a band singing in a living room or something.
Yeah, they've optimised their brand. Anyway, number 39.
It's Graham Gouldman and Brian May with Floating in Heaven.
Brian May... being a badger-loving astrophysicist and former member of Queen, Graham, co-lead bassist of 10cc, the only original member still in 10cc. What, do we have anything else to say about this?
Well, I have a few things to say about it from what we were talking about last time. Sally seems to be champing at the bit here, though.
No, I thought it was unremarkable, including that it had the exact same Brian May solo that's in everything Brian May ever does.
I find that reassuring, though.
Do you? Mm. I was waiting for it to come, and it very much did come.
It does, doesn't it?
It was exactly the same. But I noticed Mike said at the end that was the James Webb Space Telescope.
In
the video. So it was a feast for the eyes.
Yeah, and, you know, with the moment he said that, I thought, no prizes for guessing who the primary energy source of this song was. Because, as we know, because he even found a way to work as sort of script consultant or something on the Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody film. Brian managed to find a way to crowbar a bit in the film where the guy who's playing him says to Freddie, and with a great astrophysicist like me behind you, there's no way we can fail. Mm. So they worked in a mention of he's being an astrophysicist. So, you know, he's clearly very proud. He's a leading academic in the field, so I guess he's quite right to be proud of it. I was quite confused about Graham's vocal, which sort of sounds like it's been recorded via a Ring doorbell or something.
Did he zoom it in, do you think? He might have done. He just sang along to the track.
It is a bit zoomed,
It reminded me a bit of, you know, the Björk record when she's downstairs at the milk bar. There's more to life than this, I think it is, isn't it? When she's singing to the... It sounded like that, didn't it? Really, like he was down a tunnel.
Bless him.
Weird.
Right, my quiz is, someone at Channel 5 told me there are only now two subjects within music documentaries that people will watch. Can you guess which two they are?
Say again, music documentaries.
Yeah, two bands, say, that people will tune in for now, music documentaries on Channel 5. Otherwise, it's a goner.
Wow.
Who are the two artists?
I mean, I guess Queen.
Yes, is one. It's not a very difficult quiz, this.
No, but, you know...
But it's quite interesting that it's now been reduced to that.
It's interesting, but not surprising. Mm. When I was at school, so I grew up in South Wales, went to comprehensive school, and I would say, hands down, the most wildly popular band at my school amongst boys was Queen. They were all absolutely obsessed with Queen.
Did a single one of those boys
suspect? I do think about that sometimes. I mean, they couldn't have been because it would not have been permitted to have loved a band. But I mean, how did they not know?
I mean, yeah.
We all know under the surface, don't we? Maybe just at the unspoken.
It was sort of... But I think in a way, if I take out the fact that I hated school and I hated all those boys, looking back, in a way, it's sort of sweet. Oh, yeah. Because it's kind of, it's permissible flamboyance, campness. It's a sort of, it's a masculine permitted.
Yes.
I mean, why did they think the band was called Queen?
I mean, they were so, so popular. And those guys, I'm 50 next birthday, so...
Are they the drunk ones that come up to you?
No, they're of a slightly younger generation. But the boys I went to school with are all now like 50.
Yes.
So I would think they'd be absolutely that audience who would tune in to a documentary. Are you about to say that the other one is 10cc?
No.
Is it Pink Floyd?
No.
Ah, I'm surprised.
You'll kick yourselves when you hear
it. Oasis?
It's ABBA.
Oh, sure.
But similarly, camp.
Sure. Sure.
So that's quite interesting. The simile has that pull, I would have thought.
Also, I mean, ABBA's multi-generational, isn't it? Kids know all the words to ABBA just
and
as old people do
as
when you go and see the show. I've never seen a more mixed crowd in terms
of... amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I also wanted to quickly mention, we had spoken about hashtag funeral call last time, and these lyrics seem to be absolutely about death. And it's meant to be going to a different planet. It's meant to be astrophysics. But there's the ideas of promise of a brand new day. And the last bit is, I'm floating in heaven, I'm so high, wave the world goodbye. I mean, obviously, it is about that. Elephant in the room again, addressed.
Yes, this elephant doesn't leave the room when we're talking about the Heritage Chart Show.
Really can't get it out.
No.
At 33, the highest new entry is Malibu from Matt Hoy. Just to say, 33 is not a very high new entry, is it?
I want to say something about this because I have seen this come up quite a few times with Mike Reed's Heritage Chart. He announces that Matt Hoy's Malibu is in it. Did you say 32?
33.
33, my apologies. And he says, no video as yet.
Mm.
No video as yet. I'll let you know when it comes in.
Oh, yes.
This is not good enough. It doesn't seem good enough.
And yet, no, especially
we've
given that...
we've got words to say about that.
Okay, good.
One position later, at number 32... Ralph McTell didn't supply a video either, and yet, quote-unquote, our producers went to the trouble of making one. He said, our lovely editors have put together a fantastic video for that. Which I just, why? I mean, I love Ralph. I've met him. He's a lovely guy. But I don't really understand why Ralph gets to have a video made for him and Matt Hoy doesn't, does he?
No. Favouritism going on there, Mike.
Definitely this favouritism. Yes, he says that they'd put together a video having just apologised for the lack of video. But yes, what was that about? And to have them next to each other in the chart felt a bit pointed, didn't it?
What did you think of Ralph's song? Do you want to describe it for us, maybe? Can you remember too much about it?
Not a huge amount, although I do find Ralph's voice, and I mean this in a kind way, quite soporific. I find it quite relaxing. I do remember that when I was at school, somebody at my school, who was like quite a nice, nerdy, quiet girl, once wrote on the blackboard before a lesson, Ralph McTell is life. And so whenever I think of Ralph McTell, I think of her. I won't say her name. But Ralph McTell is life. Mm. And so when the teacher came in and rolled down the blackboard, it bore the legend, Ralph McTell is life.
Yes.
And so every time I see him now, I think of Tickle on the Tum, the children's TV show, and Ralph McTell is life.
Well, Ralph would love you for that, because when most people think of Ralph McTell, obviously they think of Streets of London, which was obviously the subject of a... I don't know if you remember the big train sketch. Do you remember the sketch about that? When who's that comedian who was on Big Train a lot?
Kevin Eldon?
Yes, thank you very much. Kevin Eldon is playing Ralph McTell, and the sketch starts with the final closing strains of Streets of London. He's in a folk club or something, packed house, and then everyone sort of cheers, and then they start shouting for Streets of London. He's already played it, but they don't. The joke is they don't want to hear anything else. They just came to hear him do Streets of London, and that's that.
Yeah,
and. A few years later, I ended up making a documentary for Radio 4 because I'm obsessed with the idea of albatrosses, how people deal. I've got a theory about albatrosses.
Mm-hmm. Musical ones?
Primarily musical ones, yeah. Less so the bird.
Okay, just to clarify.
Because I think when you have an albatross, the stages you go through with it are like the five stages of grief.
Yes.
A similar sort of process. Denial, anger, bargaining.
Right, yes.
And you can sort of see that with... Liam Gallagher's a very good example of this. Mm. He formed BDI. That was the denial phase. Didn't play any Oasis songs. Didn't want to talk about Oasis. Mm. It was all about BDI, BDI, BDI. Mm. Then bargaining. BDI would have a couple of Oasis songs in the encore. So, yeah, if you stay for the main set, then, you know. And then it goes on and on. And then finally you get acceptance. And now, you know, Liam liberally peppers his set with Oasis songs. The original songs he does are like classic Oasis songs anyway.
And Morrissey now does There's a Light That Never Goes Out.
Right, yeah.
Well, this is all part and parcel of the heritage artist, surely. Those are the stages you go through to become a heritage artist when you embrace your part.
Of course, Liam Gallagher and Morrissey are both very, very, very rich men. I would imagine that finances speed up the trajectory quite significantly.
They cushion
the
blow.
If you're, say, Genuine Pony, you're going to run through that phase quite quickly, but before you know it, you'll sing Pony five times on the stage in Vegas.
Well, Ralph, I interviewed various people for this radio show. All of whom had albatrosses of one kind or another. And some were quite... So, for instance, Sandy Shaw was very resistant to the idea that the five stages of grief applied to albatrosses. I didn't tell Ralph what the documentary was about prior to meeting him.
Yeah.
And when I said it was like a light had gone on. It was like his jaw dropped. It was, oh, my God. That's exactly what it was like. I just imparted the secrets of the universe to him. Yeah, and he just kind of went through it in his head, because I wouldn't play it for a while. And actually, I was quite angry at times.
Bless Ralph McTell.
Hello. And then, I just took some time out and my anger subsided and I realised, actually, I'm very lucky to have had one hit.
Oh.
And this wave of love came over me. It's just all like he was living it in real time in front of
me. Bless him.
I know, I felt
Ralph like McTell is life.
Yeah, he is. And he's a lovely man. I've met him subsequently. He's a lovely, lovely man.
Well, Matt's maybe why he got a very special video. They knew he was lovely.
Indeed.
Not Matt Hoy,
Which is very reminiscent, I thought, of the Golden Oldie Picture Show. Does anyone remember the Golden Oldie Picture Show?
Yeah, I don't very well.
Quite depressing, wasn't it?
It was. But they were trying to do something new, I guess. They were just saying, okay, well, why shouldn't old people who liked music in a time before music videos not have their videos for their favourite songs?
Yeah.
So that's that. But you're right. It was that whole programme did have a slightly soporific air about it. Not many have made it to YouTube because I have looked. There aren't many Golden Oldie Picture shows that have been, which is a shame. But anyway,
it seemed to be on for about 3 days, didn't it? It was so long. I had entered the demographic by the time it finished.
Yeah, the song again, I think probably a metaphor for, if not euthanasia, at least a peaceful passage to the hereafter.
His acceptance, isn't it?
Very much the Buddhist
PDF he's read as well.
I wouldn't go as far as to say hospice pop, but if someone does want to.
Palliative pop.
Yes.
Palliative pop, wonderful. You've done it. Mike Reed's crafting his narrative after this one, as we were talking about his narrative. This is the chart you want that you vote for every week, he says. And the auto-suggestion was like, yes, I agree. I've dropped my glasses. Yes, I will do. This is my chart. And there was something about that he's just getting the message in there, which I'm happy to be part of Mike's cult.
Thanks.
He does say top two voting places in Switzerland, Geneva and Zurich, top two, and the top two voting areas of Spain are Malaga and Alicante.
That's not too surprising, because big expat communities.
Big expat communities. They're having their egg and chips. Tuning in.
Yes. Again, the holiday feel is always bringing to mind.
Yeah.
We don't yet have the pictures, which we have in later episodes of these beautiful places from Getty Images.
He mentions that Hazel Dean's been on the charts for 32 weeks consecutively, which I thought was an interesting factoid.
Mm. Well, it's the way old friends do, and that's from her album of ABBA covers, which I've listened to. It's not bad.
Mm. So she did a sort of erasure thing?
Yeah, she chose a few deep cuts, you know, one for the heads, you know. the way old friends do being a case in point, because it was a live recording on the end of their Super Trooper album. Mm. And that's the only place it exists. So hats off to Hazel.
Well, 32
she
weeks.
She knows the audience as well. See, mm. ABBA. Yeah.
Number 24, we've got the Jive Aces now. Mm. This is a fascinating group.
There's so much to unpack here, isn't there? There's so much to say about this. So the Jive Aces are a sort of early 50s pastiche jive swing thing. They've got three girls who are like kind of Primark pipettes, sort of thing. And they filmed this on Brighton Pier, and it feels, we'll find out later, I feel like there was a twofer that day. I feel like the production team, the production team.
As
had,
we're here.
Yeah,
we've got everything set up.
they all went down to Brighton, but this is the first appearance we see on Brighton Pier. It features a PA from Mike Reed. Is he drumming? Or he's doing something? Or he's an MC?
He's an MC.
He's got the vintage mic.
Yeah, so he brings that mic everywhere. So he's introducing it.
They are semi-finalists from Britain's Got Talent in 2012. I believe they made a reappearance sort of 8 years later in some kind of all-stars type thing. But anyway, they were semi-finalists in 2012. As I say, they're this kind of pastiche jive band. But also, significantly, they're not just Scientologists, they're not just members of Scientology, they're actually members of the Sea Org, which brings me to another obsession of
mine.
What
is the Sea Org?
So the Sea Org is essentially the sort of professional wing of Scientology, meaning they are people who physically work for the church. So they are notionally paid by the church, but they're not. They earn practically nothing, and they live in what has been described as slave-like conditions by former members of the Sea Org. When you join the Sea Org, and lots of people who join are children, their parents, their Scientologist parents sign them up to the Sea Org, they have to sign a billion-year contract saying that they will work for, you know, beans, basically, for the church for the next billion years in all of their incarnations, in all of their lives. So the Jive Aces have been given day release to be on Mike Reed's.
Are they all Scientologists, or some of them have stragglers?
I couldn't say this for a fact.
Right.
From what I could find out, they are all members.
Okay.
But please, I may be wrong.
Yes, we can be corrected, yeah.
But the difference between being a Sea Org member and a Scientologist is massive, because if you're a Sea Org member, your entire life is devoted to the church. You are ruled by the church. You work for the church. You earn very little money. You live with other Sea Org members. You don't grow up with your parents. You grow up with other Sea Org members, and you in these sort of dorms. You don't necessarily have a phone contact with the outside world. You're a kind of cadet.
Right.
And back in the day, L. Ron Hubbard would have them on a ship, would literally have them on a ship away from everybody, cleaning the decks and so on.
Not far from Brighton Pier, maybe, that ship is docking.
So as somebody who is fascinated by Scientology and has been for many years, I must say I was quite surprised to see British Sea Org members, because the church is now small, although they pretend to be massive. The church is so small. I suppose I had not imagined there were still Sea Org members in the UK, but not only are there, but they also have a jive and swing band that Mike Reed likes. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing from top to bottom.
Yes.
I found out all sorts of things about them. I'd never heard them prior to this point. I'd missed the Britain's Got Talent stuff. This song is called Music, Music, Music. Pretty catchy.
Well, it's the cover, isn't it?
So original in 1950, music, isn't it?
Yeah. By the bloke who wrote for Elvis.
I noted with interest that an American doctor once prescribed their version of Bring Me Sunshine to someone who was suffering from depression.
Okay.
Which leads me to ask you, Sally, if you were clinically glum, would you like a doctor to prescribe the Jive Aces? If not, then what songs would work for you?
Okay, that's a good question. No, I wouldn't want that song. My instant cheer-uppers, I suppose, I'm really sad and I just want to feel instantly better, I would have maybe I Want You Back by the Jackson 5, or a sort of banger like Family Affair by Mary J. Blige.
Both. Can't argue with either of those. How about you, Sean?
Oh, this is such a difficult question, but I go into hip-hop. I'd go into, I'll just do a load of Kendrick Lamar is what I'll do. I'll go into something that just completely alters the reality, or just go darker is the other thing. And you think, that person's more miserable than me. Just, yes, really go into very dark, very gloomy guitar rock or something like that. I mean, I'm thinking Leonard Cohen, but we could go darker than that.
No, I'm the same. I would either steer into the skid or go for a banger very often, hip-hop. Yes. Dr. Dre is very good in that situation. Anything produced by Dr. Dre, like
Even
No Diggity
Kanye,
or something.
Because it's so crazy. Yeah. You can just go into somewhere else. I know we're not allowed to mention people like that, but we can. We can do the hits. What about you, Pete?
I know I'm going to sound like a simpleton. In many ways, you know, I am a simpleton, really, but I actually find that Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin.
Do you?
And here's why. It poses no solutions to the problems that it mentions. It itemises quite a long list of problems in its lyrics, and it's just giving you an order just to simply stop worrying and be happy. And I just think there's a lot to be said for that fake it to make it sort of energy that you can bring to things. I think if you can kind of pretend to be the things that you want to be, then that's kind of halfway to actually achieving it.
Another song that I absolutely adore is Happy by Pharrell Williams.
Yeah,
you're saying that.
It works.
It does work. And Tyler, the Creator, my hero, is in the video as well, looking really cool. But there's this weird thing that I can't get out of my head that originally when I heard it, it says, happy like a room without a roof. And I thought, well, that sounds awful because all the weather would fall in. So there was this poignancy that I had put on that record that I can't get away from that sort of makes it even more clinically beautiful to me, that song.
Sometimes a song is telling you that it's going to work and then it just does, and you sort of like, Ooh Child is another one, isn't it? Where it's telling you it's going to make you happier and it actually does.
Yeah. Auto-suggestion works every time.
And so to number 20.
Yes, it's the Beatles of punk, according to their website. It's the Boys with She's the Reason. And the video is shot, as we know, at quote-unquote legendary rock venue, etc., etc.,
The 100 Club.
Yes. What's there to love about this, Sally?
I thought it was very powery poppy, wasn't it?
Yeah,
more than punk rock. I thought it was, it was like a power pop banger, really. I thought it was pretty good for them.
I really liked it.
I like sort of old punks who just kind of just keep on rocking.
Going.
They just keep on going. They don't change their hair. They don't change their clothes. They show absolute fidelity to the thing they loved when, you know, essentially when their balls dropped. And they just keep on going. And what I love about old punks who never really have that moment of mainstream success is they never tidy up their sound. It's still a bit messy. It's still a bit falling apart. It's still recorded a bit. The levels are all a bit too loud. And that's quite thrilling. Whereas a younger equivalent, they'd be too respectful of the form and it would come out sounding a bit compressed, a little bit neutered.
What I like is that they've sort of hidden the logo of the 100 Club for some reason, even though you know.
Even though it's very obviously the 100 Club from the first
But record. With a sheet that says The Boys, like they're at the Village Fete or something, and they're selling cucumbers or homemade cakes. Or yeah, we're The Boys. This is what we put up. This is the backdrop. It's fine. The sheet is not very big. It's they could have done with some signage.
It's a little sheet.
Yes.
I felt that was unnecessary because there was a sort of giddy purity about them doing it at the 100 Club. Yeah. In that it was just a performance video somewhere that I imagine they would have been really happy to be performing at. And I felt they should have just left it.
Yeah.
I often find with old rockers like that who are now easily into their 50s, probably in their 60s, is that often when you see them in a family environment, you see their children, and they're very much the other way. I remember in Birmingham, where I was growing up in Birmingham, there were two local rock legends one of them was called Dave Cusworth, and he was in a group called Dave Cusworth and the Bounty Hunters. Mm-hmm. And he dressed and he looked like Keith Richards at his piratical, optimal sort of post-exile on Main Street era. And we had a mutual friend, a guy called Joe Foster, who ran a record label in Birmingham. And I used to help Joe run some errands from time to time. I was at college at the time. And Joe and I had to go to Dave Cusworth's house lunchtime to pick up some records. And his curtains were drawn and you know, there weren't really many sort of signs of life from the outside. But Joe let himself in through the side door. And there were just like bongs and empty bottles and like full ashtrays everywhere, and Dave looking like Keith Richards in 1972. And then amongst it all, an immaculately attired schoolboy who was just who'd just come home for lunch and was just going back to school, just like a lovely kid, just like you would just think he'd come out of just a normal, respectable, middle-class house. And I thought, there's something in that. That was actually a beautiful image.
Yeah.
And I reckon the boys, if the boys have had families, all their children are probably a bit like that as well.
You possibly made them that sign in art or something. And they've popped it up for their kids.
Oh,
maybe.
Bless. It's like when you go to Hamleys and you sort of see those goth couples who've got a tiny child and they're sort of full of the regalia and chains and metals and black and PVC, and the child looks like it's straight out of, you know, Frozen or something, Disney princess. So you're absolutely beautiful, gorgeous,
Tinkerbell
and normal.
Wings.
Yeah, all that sort of thing. Beautiful. We have some more of our sort of admin problems here when Mike Read back announces the boys as number 20. Says Howard Jones is 21. Howard Jones is actually 20 and the boys are 21 and the graphic is this and that. And you're going, Mike, just look at the auto cue again.
It's just Mike there, you know.
It's the time warp of this programme. It's just absolutely incredible. The only reason why I know this is July 2022 is because the Commonwealth Games thing in it. Other than that, it just could exist any time, in any place.
Yeah.
We know that. I just want to say quickly that the boys do have an album called Punk Rock Menopause. I wasn't quite sure about boys, as in men, having the woman's menopause, taking that, is that good, or do we not care? Is that punk rock?
I find it slightly charming that they've used the word somehow. Yeah. There's something a bit
I guess if male menopause has passed into the lexicon, then I guess this is maybe just an extension of that. I don't know.
Maybe. That's okay. Get them some patches, see how they like it. At 14, it's the Clarisse Sisters with Butterflies in June. They've got a lot of this, a very, very sweet video here.
How do you explain the Clarisse Sisters?
So, first of all, they're perfectly competent singers. Like, they're session singers,
yes,
they've got good voices.
Yeah.
I think it's said, isn't it, that I think Mike reveals, or it's in the caption, that they're session singers and they've formed this act. Mm. So there is half a lyric in the song that mentions trains, and they really run with it, don't they?
Yes.
They really run with it. So there's loads of footage of London Bridge Station.
Yes.
And from then on, the video is just super literal in, you know, everything. But of course, the one thing they can't get, seemingly, is the butterfly enclosure at the Natural History Museum, because they keep mentioning butterflies, but we ignore the butterflies.
Like one in Austerley that you sometimes can go to. And also butterflies in June. I suddenly thought, are there loads of butterflies in June, or are there no butterflies in June? Then I got worried about butterflies.
Fair.
Led me on to, what's the metaphor here?
I don't know, but they obviously could not get their hands on any butterflies because they reference literally everything in the song except the main thing in the song.
Yeah.
They have a very storied history of sessions.
Yes,
they're from Mauritius, and I think they're really massive in Mauritius.
Mm.
Indeed, yes. And I think they had some sort of a break when they did the backing vocals on Erasure's ABBA-esque EP.
Oh, OK.
On their website, they say that was a day to remember.
Yes, Andy Bell spotted them, didn't he, when he was on holiday, or they were somewhere exotic and then got them in, is the story.
So I was wondering last night, and I thought Pete and Sian will know the answer if there is an answer. Are there any other famous Mauritian musical exports?
There must be.
There must be.
This is where the listeners are all shouting. It's good, but it's so and so and so and so.
I resisted Googling because I thought, I think Pete and Sian might know if there is an answer.
That's flattering.
No, off the top of my head.
I'm just looking at famous people from Mauritius and hoping that there'll be some.
Because it's small, Mauritius.
Yes.
It's a small place.
Delicious, Mauritius.
I mean, I don't actually recognise any of these people, which is, I'm sure, is my bad. But who's Carl de Souza? Is he a novelist and a national badminton player? So people are multitasking.
So I'm sure I'll fall down a rabbit hole with this later after the show. I wonder if there are any British people with Mauritian heritage. Maybe my next port of call.
I mean, most of my knowledge of Mauritius extends to the fantastic Mauritian food concession at Woodgreen Shopping City. But there are. It's a fascinating video for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
You picked up on the use of a phone box, didn't you, Sian?
Yes, the sisters can afford black cab because we see them in the back of one, and yet they are using a phone box to call someone and sing the lyrics to. And you do think, in this day and age, who uses a phone box? Someone get them a mobile. It'll be fine. But we're feeling that they, as they are visitors to London, maybe, that this is their, this is what London is like if you're a visitor.
It's on their bucket list,
yeah,
London.
You go in a red telephone box, although we can't see the telephone box and we know that most of them aren't red anymore.
And they don't contain a
don't
phone
work.
Anymore.
Yes.
They should have strolled
yes.
in and found a defibrillator, shouldn't they?
Or just a lot of saucy lady cards.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah. Also, there's a fantastic thing. Where there's a shot, they're walking past things, there's a shot of a Union Jack Smeg fridge. And you think, someone has had that conversation with, go, look, it's the Union Jack Smeg fridge. And we'll go, oh, cut that out. No, no, keep it in.
Yeah.
Cut it out. Why would I? No, keep it in. And there's been something quite long. It's only a couple of seconds or something. We're definitely, this is very much the part of British culture that we really want in there. Very confused idea of what anything is. I love that bit. I think this fridge should be a little bit
It
more.
Did seem professionally filmed, is what
oh,
I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah.
It did feel as though there was some kind of crew in place and not someone's granddaughter on a Nokia.
There's, you know, these are clearly dignified women who have had a lot of life behind them and between them. And I do feel sad at the thought of what that phone box would have smelled like when they...
yeah, it's a bit embarrassing.
When they went in there. Also, there's a bit in the record shop. You have to go to the actual official video to see the full record shop bit, but there's a bit where it's suggested to them that it would be a good idea if they just pop into a record shop and just idly browse the racks. Bizarrely, the record shop that's been chosen for them to go into is Fonica Records, which is a specialist left field dance and electronica based record shop in,
but why not?
In Poland Street. And then we get to see some really crack acting here, where they're kind of pulling out records with like obscure white labels from other acts and putting them on the turntable, like listening to them looking really interesting
yeah.
through the headphones.
Yeah.
And you see, they, you poor things, you know, you're having to pretend you're really enjoying the last 12-inch released on the Hyper Dub label.
Yeah, but maybe they are. I mean, come on.
Yes.
Maybe they are.
Yeah, you're right. Yes. I'm
also
prejudging.
Yes, yes. I mean, we don't know. They are very lovely ladies. They are delicious from Mauritius. I would say that the train station now seems to have supplanted Carnaby Street. If you remember, as a place where you film a video, presumably
yeah.
Carnaby Street's too expensive. You've got to get
I
a
guess.
License. Do you remember in the 80s?
Mm.
Loads of videos of Carnaby Street and here are all the people and kissing a baby on the head. It now seems to be Eurostar, London Bridge, all those sorts of places. Because it may be
and
free.
And Holborn, Holborn Underground Station
right.
is always the station, or was always the station
right.
in pop
yeah.
videos. So if you got a licence or permission from London
It'd
Underground, they would send you to Holborn.
Yeah.
Because it's not that heavily trafficked.
Yes.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of really wide corridors and lots of escalators and so on. It's an oversized station. It's too big for its needs.
Right.
And so whenever you see a pop video, it's usually Holborn.
Mm. Number 13, Mickey Dolenz with My Heart Is Failing Me, which is, I did think was just a touch ironic because he's the only remaining member of the Monkees whose heart hasn't failed him. And then at number 12, The Proclaimers.
Mm.
With an extraordinary piece of music in all sorts of ways. It's called The World That Was. Any thoughts, Sally?
Yes, well, this started a two-parter for me.
Yes.
We'll obviously come back to the song that followed it that's kind of in the same vein. So I feel fondly towards The Proclaimers.
Mm.
I feel fondly towards
them.
This song is called The World That Was. And they're actually sort of making a serious point here. The song is about the ridiculousness of nostalgia and how, you know, we're in a place politically and sentimentally as a country where we want to hark back to a time when Britain was a thing that, of course, Britain never was that thing. But then, so they're making a point that I think is valid. It's true. It's this kind of anti-Brexit, slightly, you know, overtones of that. But then it's accompanied by this video that's really nostalgic and sentimental, that's not satirical at all, that's like a kind of a bit of a sort of Jive Bunny montage type thing. And so the point they're making is kind of lost. And I also felt on a gut level that it was also lost on Mike Read. Mm. I felt that Mike Read was doing a kind of Born in the USA misunderstanding. I felt he was a kind of redneck loving Born in the USA because he's a fierce patriot. It's that kind of a sense for me.
I'm not sure, but only because when he goes out of the video back to Mike in the studio, mm-hmm. he looks a bit cross.
Oh, did you feel that? Interesting, because he is, of course, a UKIPper and an Independence Party guy.
Yes. Indeed, yeah. And that's, I noticed, in marked contrast, the following song, which was by the Fratellis. Mm.
The Fratellos, as he called them.
He did. But he loved the song. Not so much that he remembered to say their name, but he made a point of talking about how much he liked that song. Mm. He passed no judgment whatsoever.
Interesting.
On the Proclaimers song.
Interesting.
These lyrics, I mean, they're really lyrics. Taking the battle to the heart of the opposition.
Yes. So
do you think that he saw the name of the song and thought, well, sounds like my kind of song. Let's go. And then when he heard it, he realised he'd been sold apart.
He'd been diddled, yeah. I mean, but worship of the past that never was is totally demented. That's the final line in the song. You know, it's completely at odds with Mike's brand.
Is this their Trojan horse? Is actually this a Proclaimers knowing that... I mean, if we're on episode 22, we've had 4 months of Heritage Chart. So acts are now thinking, oh, I can get on this if I've got a video. Yeah. If I've got a very nice, you know, couple of clips of, you know, one of my grandparents and a letter and the things that, you know, are accompanying this video, but the lyrics are saying something difficult. Maybe this is what they're doing. And I think that's quite clever.
Quite aggy. You know, the musically it was quite aggy as well. Mm. Sounded like Jumping Jack Flash, or as my notes say, Jumping Jock Flash.
Way.
Well, this, but to Sean's point, so this brings me to a question I had for both of you. Mm. Of course, I bring questions to this podcast in the full knowledge that there is no satisfactory answer to any question related to this programme. But is consent obtained from the artist? So do PRs of more kind of credible artists just avoid the emails? Or is there a place where these videos are downloaded? Like how we know that some of the acts clearly pitch and make a bespoke video. We know that's clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for someone like the Proclaimers or the Fratellis, is consent obtained?
Well, that's what
the Proclaimers know that they're going to be on.
When we were talking about Bruce Springsteen and his very glossy video, who said yes?
Correct.
Did he say yes? Did his people say yes?
And take that on it quite a lot.
Yeah.
If it's a promotional video, then do you get to veto?
Yeah, maybe you don't.
This is exactly my inquiry. Like, are PRs just kind of studiously ignoring any email from that office, or is it? Beyond their control.
It's one of many, many mystifying issues that we've yet to resolve.
Again, it's a question I don't know if I always want to resolve it. I don't know if I want to know. I'd rather sometimes not and ponder what happens.
I feel like the Heritage Chart show is moving at such speed.
The velocity with which it comes at you.
And the velocity with which he has to keep making them, because there's one a week. That he hasn't got time to wait and see if Bruce Springsteen wants his bloody video on his show.
Yeah.
There'll be another one in 6 days. Suck it up, Bruce.
The reason that I ask, we've just had the Proclaimers, but to slightly jump the gun to the Fratellis, I would think that the Fratellis had bigger ambitions for themselves than the Heritage Chart. I mean, they're still relatively new in the grand scheme of the Heritage Chart. Yeah. You know, 10 years ago, this would have been a big record, you know.
Yeah.
And I would imagine their ambitions are bigger than this. And so is it an unstoppable train that they find themselves on the Heritage Chart show? Or do they think, do you know what, let's paper the house, you know?
Is it circumvented because people vote? It's the people's vote. It's the people's choice.
It's like
a referendum, isn't it? Hang on a minute. And so therefore, it's the viewers who've decided and that's what
one must respect the result.
Absolutely. Well, the will of the people.
Just like people voted for Putin the other day.
Should we talk about the badly filmed Radio 1 roadshow montage?
This, for me, was the highlight of the show. It was absolutely extraordinary.
This is very on brand.
Extraordinary. Mm. So, after the Fratellis, we go into a very long kind of medley montage of clips of the Radio 1 Roadshow featuring Mike Read. So we open with Simon Mayo, Jackie Brambles and Mike Read singing Teddy Bear's Picnic on stage and doing a sort of funny dance. And you think, well, that's a bit weird. Mm. But then it goes on and then we see him, Mike Read, hitting tennis balls into the crowd. Then we see him playing Rocking All Over the World. Mm. And then we see him larking about with Captain Sensible.
Yes.
And before you know it, what feels like about 8 minutes.
A lifetime.
And it's this sort of home footage. Of course, this predates... The Radio 1 Roadshow predates smartphones. Mm. So you have these kind of rudimentary, you know, these crappy camcorder type footage, you've been framed type thing.
Yeah.
And it's all fuzzy and it's really badly edited. But he very, very clearly wants you to take a moment to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, which I thought was so telling, and I'm sure you two noticed this, he said, well, you know, That was some clips of Radio 1 Roadshow. Might be back for the big anniversary next year.
Yeah.
He's pitching.
I know.
He's pitching.
Because the next year is 50 years. It marks 50 years of the Radio 1 Roadshow.
Right.
And it is. I noticed that. It's
he's pitching.
He's just saying, guys, I don't know if you remember, and, you know, I look what a big part of it I was. Mm. And it's very human, isn't it? It's very sort of... You know,
and he
Don't Forget Me. I should have Don't Forget Me by Harry Nilsson playing over it.
And he ends it on this slightly tantalising note that makes you think, oh, has he been contacted? Is he considering his options? Mm. But actually, he's just letting everyone know the anniversary's coming up and they should do something big involving him, although they had their fingers burnt with Top of the Pops and Jimmy Savile, didn't they?
Yeah, I
would think that they're probably not going to plunder the history.
I think they've decided that, you know, Tony Blackburn is the one reliable, safe guy who kind of embodies Radio 1 of that era.
Yeah.
And he's the one that they'll most probably sort of get back to say, look at what Radio 1 was then.
Yeah.
And so as long as Tone's around, I think it might be difficult potentially for Mike to get a look in.
Yes, he's a safe pair of hands, isn't he, Tony? Yeah.
Do we have much to say? Ricky Ross and an acoustic piano version of Your Loving Arms, which was originally a hit for Deacon Blue, I think in the early 90s, is next up. I couldn't really think of very much to say about this one.
This is the bit where we have the middle of the programme and he chooses a ballad, Mike Read, and I think, I just fell asleep. You know, it's the falling asleepy moment.
I went for a pee.
That sort of thing. It's black and white.
He looks good, though, I thought.
Yeah, looks all right. It's not awful,
looks pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah, and by all accounts, a lovely guy.
And he can sing.
Lovely guy, by all accounts. And
still got a good voice.
Yeah. I just sort of thought that... I think the original song had a bit of a post-Achtung Baby kind of slightly scuzzy production. And I think, by and large, I'd probably err towards that one.
He's another one who can afford to be more ambitious because Deacon Blue sell out quite big gigs now. They're doing a kind of revival, sounds rude, because... They play these proper big gigs and they sell out.
Yeah, they've got a huge following. Yeah, they've cultivated that quite deliberately and, you know, the old songs stand up. We return to a theme that introduced the show, which is bands that have split into two factions. I'm talking, in this case, about The Fizz.
The
group featuring three original members of Bucks Fizz. Mm-hmm. The name Bucks Fizz belongs to Bobby G., who also has his version of Bucks Fizz, which is obviously just him, and I believe his wife.
Yes, he's the sort of Yoko G character who kind of, you know, is blamed for having caused the trouble in the first place, maybe unjustifiably, but...
Yeah. I've looked into this quite a lot. Bobby is quite an earnest character. As you would expect of someone business-minded enough to own the brand, he runs a very tight ship, works very hard. It's a sort of two-person operation, him and his wife. And somewhere along the line, you feel like the fun slightly migrated to the version that obviously has the other three members of Bucks Fizz in it. The song, I'm just trying to look at my notes. I've forgotten what the song is called.
But I didn't write it down either, but it's sort of...
Nor did I.
it's kind of counterpoint to the Proclaimers song.
Yes.
So it's the counterpoint to the Proclaimers song because it is constantly saying, well, the lyrics are literally, all I want is the world we left behind. Oh, yeah. It'll never be the same again. And the whole song is about how it used to be much better than it is now. And it'll never be as good as it used to be. And of course, the original lineup of Bucks Fizz, I think certainly Cheryl and Jay are Brexiteers, are they not? They came out in favour of Leave. Yes.
Jay is, I don't know about Cheryl.
I thought Cheryl and Jay were, but I'm, again, I'm happy
Jay
to be corrected. Jay
is
certainly
on record, yes.
I feel like The Fizz came out for Leave, and they very much continued in that vein with this song. They are the second of three bands in dispute or previous dispute over the name of their band.
Yeah.
As you rightly said, Bobby G and Yoko G, I can't remember her name, had it for a while. Mm. It temporarily drifted as a name into the hands of David Van Day, brilliantly.
Indeed it did, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that was a brilliant moment.
And there was a documentary which I know you've watched more than one occasion.
I mean, it's literally one of my favourite TV programmes of all time. There was a strand on the BBC that was sometimes called Blood on the Carpet, sometimes called Trouble at the Top. They were essentially the same programme.
Yeah.
And this was entirely about the dispute between the two factions of Bucks Fizz over who owned the name Bucks Fizz. Mm. Bobby G is in despair because Mike Nolan has joined the others in the rival Bucks Fizz.
Yes.
So he's lost Mike Nolan, and he and his wife go to David Van Day. I mean, who else would you go to for a harmonious, to weather
the
storm of an acrimonious split?
Yeah, safe pair of hugs.
Safe pair of hugs. They go to David Van Day, and David Van Day essentially wants to, you know, hire some girls in stripper costumes and he wants to turn it sexy.
Yeah.
He wants them to wear all black because it's very slimming. Mm. They go to entertain the troops in the Falklands, which is unbelievable. It's chaos where David gets too drunk and loses his temper in the Falklands at an army base. It's just pandemonium, isn't it, this documentary? Yeah. It's pandemonium. Anyway, so it ends up we have Mike Nolan rejoining Bobby G, albeit temporarily, because now he's with the original girls. Shelley has gone. Bobby is with his wife and two girls, some sort of pontins or a cruise liner or whatever. Mm. And you feel so sorry for them in the documentary. These girls have been plucked from a cruise liner or a holiday camp or something and told to wear, you know, PVC or whatever it is. And then you have this version, which is called The Fizz, because Bobby owns the name Bucks Fizz.
Yeah.
And he's in dispute with David Van Day, which I think is now resolved probably to David's satisfaction. So we have The Fizz here. They are singing the counterpoint to the Proclaimers song. And it's a nostalgia fest. It's saying it used to be much better than it is now.
Yeah.
And they seem to be wearing newspapers. It is fabric, we presume, anyway, that looks like newspapers. And it's the old days, isn't it? It's very much, this is the news when everything was lovely in 1952.
The World We Left Behind is what the song is called.
Oh, well done, yes.
Thank you very much. I mean, it is an incredible story. I was looking up a bit of a potted history as well. And when they had the car crash, I mean, this is a Netflix series to be made.
I mean, it was terrible.
And Jay was sued by the band. She'd been in a car crash. She couldn't move, but they sued her for not being in the band. She was 23. There were all sorts of things.
She left afterwards, didn't she?
Yes, and they said, oh, no, you can't do that. It was just like, what? So actually, you know, there's so much to it.
Mike Nolan was really ill, wasn't he? Mm.
He was near
death.
Touch and go. Yes. And it was, I remember, because the single they had out at the time was called I Hear Talk, which was one of my favourites. It's a great song.
It was just
hanging around at number 25, just not quite, just hanging on in there in a manner that rather mimicked what was happening to Mike Nolan himself.
Yes, it was terribly sad. And he had a severe brain injury, didn't he? There was a very long time of recuperation. And one can see why he didn't really want to be in a band
an incredible
with David
story.
Van Day and Bobby G.
Yeah, the Bucks Fizz story. And then you've got Van Day and his burger van.
Bobby G should make a virtue of his situation and call his band Bucks Swizz, because anyone turning up thinking that they've got to see all four members of Bucks Fizz needs to be prepared.
There's a memoir, Me and Bobby G, also to be written.
David Van Day, also a UKIP candidate in Brighton at one point for the council. He ran for as a UKIP councillor in Brighton, did not get in.
Brighton also has the link with ABBA winning Eurovision, of course.
You know, it's all happening.
UK, there's a lot of themes here.
So Mike ends this one with saying the new album is imminent. So this is 2022. There was a Fizz album. yeah, coming over the hill.
It was quite well reviewed. Very, I mean, I think the money seems to have migrated over to the Fizz.
Oh, really?
The video is, you know, it's a fairly polished video, and the production is pretty decent. Quite stock Aitken Waterman-y kind of vibe to it.
Also features clips of them winning Eurovision.
Yes.
So we've got that in, so we know who
quite
they
audacious
are.
Audacious as well. Did you notice that they had some clips from some civil rights footage at one point?
Yes, which, that was extraordinary.
Well, life's a battle, isn't it?
Yes.
Number six, Owen Paul, is in the chart.
I think you mean Paul Owen.
I was just about to say, Zoe. Yeah, the graphic reads Paul Owen. And then we have another Heritage Chart show gaffe.
Yeah, as a teenager, you were a bit of an Owen Paul fan, weren't you, Sally?
He was very much my era, for sure. I remember liking Pleased to Meet You more than my favourite Waste of Time. I preferred
the follow-up,
that record.
The follow-up for people who don't remember.
I don't remember.
I preferred that,
that
record.
Yeah.
He was very, very prominent on Saturday Superstore. So Mike Reed was an early adopter of Paul Owen. So the Paul graphic Owen. Says Paul Owen not once, but thereafter.
Yeah.
It's done multiple times instead of Owen Paul. And he's singing the cover that absolutely nobody asked for, which is George Michael's Dixie
Corner. Is he singing it, though? Is he singing it? No, he's shouting the cover, isn't he? He's shouting all the way through this record. Yeah. My favourite thing was going to the website, and he does have a shop, always. Am I going to click on
merch?
Shop? Of course I'm going to, yes. You can get a mug for 15 quid, but it is to
Are
order.
Are you talking about Owen Paul or
Owen
the Heritage Paul's, Chart?
The Owen Paul, but Heritage Chart should do it. You have to email Lynn at... so maybe that's whoever Lynn is. Thank you, Lynn, for ordering the mugs. But you can also order handwritten lyrics. And they're only £20, and it's on watercolour paper as well, so it sounds
that's quite
nice.
Sweet. Fantastic.
They can be a lyric of your choice. Guess what they might... I mean, everyone must say favourite Waste of Time, mustn't they?
It can't
be doing the B-sides there. But yeah, I would say that seems like quite a good bargain.
There
yeah.
then follows a bizarre roll call. There's a kind of sidebar, isn't there, after this, where Mike Reed does a roll call of all those who, like Owen Paul slash Paul Owen, came in late to the backing track on Pebble Mill.
Yes.
weird.
One for the fans there.
This is
Also, and the graphic
there's something
is good.
Very almost aggressive about the way Mike says, Owen Paul will never be allowed to be allowed to forget his appearance on Pebble Mill at One, where the cameras rolled, the song was played, but no one told Owen to sing. I said, he won't be allowed, because people, I'd forgotten, actually.
Yes, there is a gleefulness, isn't there, to this announcement. And then the other people who've also done it, although they haven't...
Who knew that there was a list of people?
Having gone through the roll call, and I can't even remember who else was on it, can you? There was about sort of 10 people.
I actually can't. I've watched it about 3 times as well.
There were various people who'd come in too late to their backing track.
Yes.
I can't remember who now, but it was like, you know, the famous, I would argue that the most famous one is This Morning and Gene Pitney. That's the famous one.
All About Eve, Top of the Pops.
Yes.
It certainly was difficult.
So he goes through this roll call, and to Pete's point, at the end of it, he then says, but nobody will, nobody.
Never be allowed to forget.
Owen Paul set the bar high or something. It's like, I don't think he did. I didn't even know that had happened.
Yeah.
No, I was dimly aware of it, I think through hearsay. I don't think I'd ever seen it myself. I mean, I think this song, this version of A Different Corner by George Michael, so he's covered A Different Corner by George Michael.
No need.
I sort of think that back in the 80s, if memory serves, I think there was a small band of pop observers who saw what George had done with that song and in the video, where he kind of looks slightly like he's having some sort of breakdown, or a little bit like, which is kind of a bit weird. Because the song is very minimal as well. What those people who love that song love about it, myself included, is that it incites concern for the person singing it, the person that you see in the video. But I think there will be people that didn't like that song because it'd be like, oh, what's he moaning about? I think just do another one like Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. And like, so this this is a corrective that will represent the latter view, I think, from Owen.
You're absolutely right. He does. George Michael did that generally, didn't he? One More Try is also concerning, isn't it? There are some songs of his where you sort of, it's a portal into his state.
Cry for help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And arguably so is this. I mean, it's a poor cover, as Sian says. It's quite shouty. Mm. It's a tender, moving song rendered cross.
Very, very cross.
Crotchety. I mean,
maybe it knows its audience. If I'm trying to think of something nice to say about it, maybe it knows its intended audience. But yeah, I hear you loud and clear.
Mm. Number three. The Roubettes, obviously the current iteration of the Roubettes, with Tomorrow. Lyrics include Tomorrow Never Comes, especially for the lonely ones. Thanks, guys. What do you think of this?
Mike credits this as Tonight, of course, not Tomorrow. Mike calls it Tonight.
Well, yes. In Mike's world, then it is called Tonight.
They did have a hit song called Tonight back in their heyday. So I think that's where Mike's confusion comes in.
Mm.
I rather like... the cold-bloodedness of this enterprise, and this isn't a backhanded compliment. Mm. I still like it when people quite almost ruthlessly and clinically give their audience what they want, because I think that's kind of a skill to that.
It takes self-awareness, doesn't it?
Yeah,
which not everybody has.
And it's sort of, you're being honest with yourself. You're a survivor. You're competitive. You want, you know, it's not about sating your artistic whims. It's okay, I'm going to provide a product. I sort of quite like that about this song. It's a sort of they're retreading Sugar Baby. It's an attempt to rewrite Sugar Baby Love, and with a sadder, more reflective lyric. So that's interesting, because I think number one around the same time as Sugar Baby Love, either just before or just after it, was Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks. And you know, if those two songs had a baby, I think this would be it.
Wow.
I know. And there's a lot of beef around. So this is the version featuring Alan Williams, who, according to their Facebook page, is referred to as the original voice of the Roubettes. Now, this is complicated because the original voice of Sugar Baby Love belongs to Paul Da Vinci, who was a session singer who only sang on that song. Mm. And my other great Sugar Baby Love fact is that it was originally offered to Shawadi Wadi.
Okay.
Turned it down.
Well, that makes sense.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, I can see how that would happen. This is the third group that has a name dispute.
Right.
Just in one show, because there are two Roubettes, aren't there? Right. And as you say, the suffix is different in each. This is the Roubettes with
Alan Williams.
Alan Williams. Yeah. They're both such forgettable names in both versions. And they're still in the whites and the flat caps. They're wearing exactly the Roubettes garb, aren't they, still?
I love that. Okay, what's our brand? Let's just kind of hammer home the brand. And that's okay, I think. You know,
it goes with the song, though, doesn't it? The spectral white, these sort of, you know, godly sort of golf playing types, this quasi religious nature. A lot of people on the beach in this episode as well.
Yeah.
They're very close to God. They're going to die in a minute. Tomorrow, we don't know.
It's a bit Randall and Hopkirk.
Yes, yes, very fine.
I realise what appeals to
this
me about that. I think it's the sort of let's get the old gang back together energy about it. It's almost like you would with a kind of heist movie. What was the famous heist in Hounslow, was it, a few years ago? The jewelry heist?
Oh yes.
And they're all like old criminals from the 70s who thought they'd just do it one more time for a laugh, you know, sort of show these young guys a thing or two, you know, this is how you do a heist. So I like it when there's that slight energy about it.
But do you think, I was thinking about this last night, do you think if you're a group, or in this case groups like the Roubettes, do you think that the mic read heritage chart is the kind of, you know, there's a race to get on it first. If you're in dispute with another version of your band, do you think it matters to the other band if you're first on? Because it's kind of the heartland of a Rubettes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Act, surely. Yes. So is it kind of laying down the gauntlet? Is it fighting talk, just as sort of when Biggie Smalls had the audacity to turn up in LA, his fate was sealed? Is it the case that the Rubettes is kind of, we got here first, this represents
absolutely.
My Creed's heritage chart reminds me of the pub in the Banshees of Inisherin.
Okay.
And so when the two brothers have fallen out, they still have to go to that pub, and they will be subjected to the scrutiny and judgment of all the other people in the pub. And so you have to bring your A game, you know, you have to sort of, you know, there's a risk of humiliation. That's all in there. That's all in there. Mike Reed's heritage chart. So, and we see that, you know, neither of them got played, so we haven't mentioned them yet. But Katrina from Katrina and the Waves has a song in the 40.
Yes.
But also so does Kimberly Rue, who was the guitarist and primary songwriter in Katrina and the Waves. And so there's no way that Katrina and Kimberly won't be sizing up the chart to see what their relative fortunes are in this week.
Exactly that. Nothing will convince me that both versions of the Rubettes don't watch Mike Reed's Heritage Chart. I mean, I feel like they're regular viewers. They know what's what. They know the movers and shakers, the runners and riders.
Yeah,
they know who
they are. Of course, yeah.
Whew, factionalisation.
So it's the number one?
Yeah. Number one in this universe is Tight Fit, If You Could See Me Now. The fact that I uncovered, I'm sure everyone knows this, but I didn't, Steve Grant, the man in it, has retinitis and is registered blind.
I didn't know that.
Can hardly see anything. It's very, very bad for him. And yet, he is the buffest late 50.
He looks
50s
very
man. He looks beautiful,
young.
Doesn't he? He's very young. He's very worked out. He looks absolutely fantastic. But the poor man is sort of battling all this other stuff.
I think he'll be in his 60s, Sean, because...
You think? Maybe I read an old article.
I was 11 or 12 when Tight Fit had their first hits. And I'm 54 now, so he's got to be in his early 60s.
Oh, so maybe he is.
Yeah.
But anyway,
he looks amazing.
Ooh, he does look amazing.
And now you say it, because you can see Denise from Tight Fit leading him along the promenade, because he's eyesight.
Former Mrs. Pete Waterman, no?
Yes.
So,
absolutely. And you know what? Whenever I see that written down, I always misread it as Dennis Waterman. That makes me laugh. It makes my life complete. Pete Waterman and Dennis Waterman together, which is another sitcom waiting to be made.
What did you think of the song?
So I feel really bad now that Sean has researched that and found I feel really bad because my feeling about it was because I knew originally Tight Fit was a sort of front, like a Milli Vanilli sort of type front. They were like proper session singers and had models like Robert Perino and people like that up front. I think I had assumed that the lineup I was looking at, that the guy had been a model, which he had been, but not a singer, which is, of course, not true. I latterly found out he did genuinely sing on Fantasy Island.
But not on The Lion Sleeps.
Correct. He sang on Fantasy Island, though. See, he can genuinely sing.
Yeah.
But I thought, looking at him originally, that he was a model and he seemed to be meeting them for the first time or like somebody promoting his local business or something. He just sort of seemed to have wandered in, you know, like those kebab houses where you see, you know, the proprietors make a little video for TikTok. It felt like he'd wandered in from that. But now I know of his difficulties. I feel absolutely terrible about it, and I'm pleased for him. But again, we're in the second part of the twofer where they've got the network rail card and they've all come en masse.
Yes. Yeah.
To Brighton.
Yeah, they're in Brighton. Yeah.
Gyvasis in the morning, afternoon Tight Fit, rap in the evening, everyone gets pissed in Brighton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a resident of Brighton, it's surprising that you didn't notice a commotion down the road.
I've been to them.
yeah. I mean, obviously, had I known they were there, I would certainly have been there. Yes. You know, I feel robbed.
I like the song. I mean, I'm a bit of a sucker for, this seems to me like a Europop version of the sort of thing that Destiny's Child were trying to do is so good. a kind of, are you finished with me? But actually, I'm doing pretty brilliantly and looking super hot.
It's I Will Survive, isn't it?
I
That's
will
what
survive.
It is, yeah. But done by steps. That's yeah. what I yes, thought. And then yes. that, I actually really liked
Fair
it.
Enough.
And I thought they looked gleeful, they're having a go, this is the right place for them. What did you think about the all-black attire, Sally? You mentioned it actually earlier, but I was going to ask you anyway, because you're a kind of visuals woman as much as uh-huh. anything else. Uh-huh. Are they making the most of themselves, or should we see them in colour?
Well, I think they're in pretty good nick, the three of them.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they look pretty great, to be honest, and so they could probably...
A bit funereal, though?
They could probably flaunt it a bit
right.
more. With a bit more... Also, they're a colourful act.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're not
oh, yeah.
a they moody, look, brooding
they look
act.
Amazing, you know, and the fact that... You know, like you say, they didn't. None of them appeared on The Lion Sleeps Tonight, but now they've effectively taken Karl Marx's advice and seized the means of control.
Yes, so that was another court case yeah. I discovered where they yes. had fought to take back,
yeah,
to yes. take back the name, and yeah. they jointly own the brand name.
That's great. I mean, it's a bit. I mean, it makes you feel good when that happens, you know, like, you know, Sugar Babe, the original version of Sugar Babes are sort of back and they own the
yeah.
name.
Yeah.
And it's in its rightful place because as the people at the front, you know, the performers work harder than anyone else works in that organisation.
Yeah.
And if they haven't written the songs for the least amount of money usually. So it's good that in the long term you can sort of have that.
And they're the only people who were both in the band and sang on the records. Everybody else was one or the other. They either sang on the records or they were in the lineup.
But in this show, we do inhabit a world where band members are not band members, band members are not songwriters, band members. I mean, this is almost every act, as we're saying in this programme that we watched episode 22, just to remind
yeah,
you.
A
band morphs. It's not even the name anymore.
No.
It's not the band name. All the things that I thought were absolutes when I was a kid have been thrown up into the air.
And you also see in this show, and I use the term supergroup loosely, but you do also see a lot of interchange. You see lots of people making guest spots, don't
yes.
you? Not on this episode, but
yeah.
on another episode.
Yeah.
You see someone leaving one band and performing with another
yes.
who
yes.
features
yeah.
somebody from another band.
I mean, you know, we've let Trigger's Brew, if you like. We've left Trigger's Broom far behind that. We're in Trigger's
have.
Hardware store, aren't we?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we certainly are.
Quick question about Tight Fit. Hmm. Little trivia thing. What connects Tight Fit to Talk Talk's final album, Laughing Stock?
Oh, damn. Back Room, is it? I don't know. I don't know offhand.
You've got me.
I love this fact. So the co-writer of Fantasy Island may have produced it as well. It was Tim Freeze-Green, who went on to be Mark Hollis's main collaborator on the final two Talk Talk albums. And that's what a storied career that man has had.
Absolutely.
And Fantasy Island is a banger, I think.
I absolutely yeah. agree. Yes,
it's
totally.
The greatest ABBA song that ABBA never did, really.
Yes, fair.
Never any room to be a music snob, is there?
Never.
No.
Which is why we're here.
It certainly is.
And that brings to a conclusion most of our pressing business of the day. Sally Hughes, thank you so much.
Thank you
us.
So much for having me. A dream come true.
You've brought...
Dream to have you.
You've brought so much. You've been so extra today. I'm very, very grateful. And, you know, we've got a long list of things to watch and pursue. You've given me much to think about on my journey home. We have some other people to thank.
We do. We thanks, as ever, to the legendary Mike Batt, who created the theme tune. If you want to release it as a digital-only single, Mike, we'd certainly be in the video. Maybe we
can in Brighton, guests. Here.
In Brighton, we can get on this show ourselves. Terrible thought. No, but thank you.
Thanks
wonderful.
To our lovely producer, Andy Lewis, as well, for making
Absolutely.
Us sound like we're halfway decent at what we do.
Thank you for listening. We really do appreciate it. And if you have any friends, tell them, and more people can listen, and maybe we can just continue. Remember, you can buy us a coffee as well, link in the show notes. We hope to see you next time. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. It's the heritage.